Hi, I'm Danny Elfman.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Debbie Harry.
This is Chris Steyer Blondie.
This is Ronan Dorzabal from Tears for Fears.
This is Billy Idol.
This is Alex Ebert, a.k.a. Edward Sharp, giving the story behind the song.
Hi, this is Peter Chotti, host of The Story Behind the Song. Each month I speak to some of music's biggest artists to get the inside stories behind their most lasting and iconic songs. Join me for new episodes on the third Monday of every month on The Story Behind the Song from the Consequence Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Everyone, welcome to the Modern Drummer Podcast for this week. Billy Amendola here again. I know we say it all the time, but our next guest is another one of those players who just, well, he's adored by every other drummer because of his feel and his groove. You know, it's just, it's his groove. It's so smooth. It feels so good all the time. Anytime he's playing the drums, you have him on a session, those drums just sound and feel incredible. So, ladies and gentlemen, no longer Canada's best-kept secret.
Billy Amendola, thank you. What a great introduction. My God, I think I have to PayPal you after this. $5. Every compliment, you get $5.
Hey, man, listen.
Thank you.
I appreciate your drumming. Just you know, I'm a fan myself. You know, I've always been, and you know, fortunately, we became friends over the last 10, 12, 15 years or whatever it is. But every drummer that I speak to always just speaks highly of you. And you know, with you, you kind of stay in the background. You're not one of those guys that push yourself on people, and you know, you stay in the background and you just do your job.
I do my best to do that. I feel like, man, there's just so much saturation and so many brilliant players. And I don't know, there's just so much going on that the best course of action is to, you know, walk softly and carry as big a stick as you can. You know, it's still always a humbling kind of path to take. I think it's important. You know, there's no point in waving your own flag all the time. We already have to do that with social media. Like, I don't know about you, but when that whole thing started, it was tough at the beginning because I had to convince myself that it's okay to like say, this is what I'm doing today. I always felt like a sense of, you know, is this braggy? Is this like,
right.
You know, and then you walk that line between don't brag, don't, you know, and people want to know what you're up to, your family, your friends, other musicians. So yeah, I mean, but thank you for saying that. But I still to this day always find myself navigating that line of trying to stay, you know, as
and a lot of times that works because the mystique too. Because if you're out there all the time, I mean, some of us, you know, some people have to be out there all the time because that's, you know, it's like, you know, even this, you know, every week, it's like, I'm tired of seeing myself and hearing myself. But you have to do it. And now that we still can't go out and interact, it's still, you know, it's still hard. So the whole internet and Zoom and the social media and all that, it's still a way of life, unfortunately and fortunately, you know. But, you know, I like what you're doing, and you know, it's, you work. So it's not like, you know, people that need to know who you are, know who you are. They hire you for you.
I just
made $15.
Exactly. I do consider myself sort of the working guy's drummer guy, you know. And I love it. I love, being able to do different things and different, you know, if I'm doing a session or a gig, it doesn't matter if the gig is at a festival in front of a big audience or at a club, you know, for 20 people, I don't care. Like, I just love the diversity of where I've ended up. You know, it's kind of cool that I get to just experience a bunch of different kind of levels, you know, different music, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, before we go back to your early days, let's start like where you are now. I know you've been out with Colby Collet touring, right?
I've been
finished that.
Just in a month of fly dates. I mean, Colby, we've been doing stuff on and off for years. Mm-hmm. So, and it comes in waves, right? So I just finished a month with Colby. In the next couple of months, I'll be back out fly dates with Smash Mouth. You know, the session things are super fun. Last week I did a session for Herb Albert, and then the next day I did a session, you know, for Steelheart, like an amazing 80s, you know, pop rock metal band. Like, it's funny the things that I walk into the studio and I'm playing a ballad for Herb, and then the next day I'm just like balls to the walls, like, oh, you know. And I love it. I love it. I can't say enough about that. But yeah, so that's what I'm doing. I mean, it's basically weekend warrior stuff, fly dates with whoever.
And how is that in these days being on the road? I mean, obviously it's got to be a little bit scary.
I mean, for sure. Obviously, we all know that. Man, the first time I got on a plane since the pandemic doors, you know, slammed down, wasn't only a couple of months ago. And it was nerve-wracking and anxiety-ridden. I mean, I'm vaccinated, and I know that there are vaccine requirements in airports and in flights and all that stuff. But still, you read the news, you hear about people getting COVID regardless. So it basically, traveling is kind of scary. You know, there's an element of apprehension that comes along with every time I'm driving to the airport. I'm like, oh God, like, you're just trying to stay in your lane and keep, you know, and physically and you know, hypothetically, you know, you just want to, you know, try and get through the travel portion. And even, you got to remember, even gigs, we used to do meet and greets after every show, right? You know, all that stuff's like new. You have to be careful about, you know, you go to sing in a microphone, has somebody wiped that microphone down? Has, you know, it's the layers and layers and layers of things that you have to try and keep an eye out for are kind of you know, overwhelming at times. So it doesn't go without anxiety or apprehension. I'm sure everybody's feeling that. So you know, I don't do a lot of bus tours. That would probably give me the most anxiety of all, because you would be stuck. And I know a lot of my friends are on bus tours, and you know, we want entertainment, we want music, we want this career to move forward and the world to, you know. But right now we're in this bizarre in-between place. We're not out of the weeds. We're not out of the weeds yet. We're half out of the weeds. So we're half, the world is half back to where it was. And so it's a little scary, you know?
Yeah. And I guess everyone just has to be aware. That's what it is. Everybody just has to stay aware. Can't let your guard down, you know, thinking, oh, this is, you know, this is fine.
That's the best way. I mean, I, you know, the best, most concise way to put it. Keep your guard up. We're not ready yet, you know?
Yeah. So, but I'm happy that you're out there playing, you know, just please be careful. I'm sure you are.
Thanks.
And so now when, being that you do studio and live, because you're also one of those guys who do both, do you play any differently when you play in the studio or as opposed to when you're playing live? Like, do you have a different approach or, you know, because some guys just say, no, I just sit down and I play. That's me.
Yeah, I think that there's a different approach. I mean, you know, it's funny with live, you can't even help it. I think subconsciously you play a little harder. You depending on the gig, of course, but you know, you are connecting with an audience. You're connecting with that's the other thing, is you're playing with people. Unfortunately, this studio life now is really by yourself. Like, people, you know, rarely you might have the artist there, you know, but for the most part, you're playing to tracks. You're playing to rough tracks, right? So the environment is not only different physically, but audio, you know, the whole thing is different. So yeah, I think that in the studio, I find I can pay more attention to my dynamics. I can pay more attention because I have more control. The other thing is, obviously, you know, you can do it again. You can punch it. So you can, you know, you can fool around with how loud or soft you're playing or how dynamic you're getting or how you hit your cymbals. The other thing too is that the gear changes. You know, in the studio, you can get away with smaller crash cymbals because the microphones are going to pick those up, you know, and all that stuff. They get mixed in a different way. Live, I always overcompensate with slightly larger, thinner, but larger crash cymbals because the decay gets lost instantaneously. If you go, you go see a band, your favorite band, the first thing I notice is if the guy's cymbals like an 18-inch crash, an 18 in the studio or in a small club is not an 18 at a festival.
Right, especially outdoors.
Sounds like a splash cymbal sometimes. It depends on, like, so you have to, you know, it depends. All the, so that's different for me too. But the thing that for most live gigs that's the same for me in my gigs is I'm still playing with click in both situations. So that actually helps the studio. It helps to not feel like I'm in a different environment, like when you're recording, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And everybody's using tracks at some point or another. And so it's almost a requirement now. You have to be able to be comfortable and not play stiff and not, yeah, you know, but the more you do it on both sides, it helps both. Like, they're always feeding each other, you know,
yep.
Because again, live, you're playing a click, but you know, things are happening all around you. It's not like the studio where you can look at a cheat note or you can just play and play. No, live, there's so many more things at play. So when you do
play live, besides the click, is there anything else? You in the ears? You're using in the ears?
Yeah, yeah.
Is there anything else besides the click?
Oh, lots. And I love it. In the last decade, I've switched over to having my own monitor mixer. So the monitor guy sends me stems. So I'll get drums just down a mono channel, bass separate, guitar separate, key separate, tracks, and click separate, vocals separate. So what happens, it takes them maybe an extra 5-10 minutes at the beginning of any show to set up. But once they do that, the monitor guy never has to look at me again. It's brilliant. Like, they're happier. They can watch the front line, which is absolutely more important to make sure your singers and your front line is happy. You don't want a guy waving from the back of the room, you know, the back of the stage, like, you know, pointing and, you know, like, so the beautiful thing is that, you know, it's an eight or 12 channel mixer. And if there's an intro to a song coming up to where I know it's acoustic guitar and I really want to lock in, I just push up the acoustic guitar and you know, I can, you know how, you know, you play, you get it.
You're in charge of what you're hearing.
So I always try and have that in my live environments. And, you know, I've been spoiled on that respect so much that even if I do a small, a gig in a club, I have a little four channel Mackie I throw a couple of 58s in a knapsack, a couple of cables, and literally I could put one on the floor beside me, put one over by the guitar, and I can still have ears and a little level click. I can still have that experience of having control. You know, once you have that monitor blasting at you, a lot of it is out of your control, and you're like, because you don't want to be that guy every
because sometimes the sound man has other things and you're trying to get his attention. Yes.
Yeah, of course.
Being a studio guy, you know about sound, so you know that's good. Everybody should be able to afford to be able to do that. I was in Nashville 2 weeks ago, and I went to the studio with Paul Long. He took me around to some of the studios, and there was a big session set up, and every single person had their own almost 24 track. I mean, it was a pretty nice sized board.
Yeah.
But, you know, because obviously there, a lot of people are recording live and all together, but I think that was one of the first times that I saw that, you know,
amazing.
You get your mix, but you always have to tell the engineer, I make this a little louder, no, lower this. Then the next song, it's a different setup.
And imagine how much time is saved on the engineer's level. You know, you got a room, you're recording a band, five guys, four guys, and each one of them, remember, I mean, you know, it's like live. Like, you know, when you're doing sound check, you're just sitting there waiting. Oh, that guy's waiting. He wants to hear more snare, more hi-hat. Oh, that guy needs more keyboard. And you're waiting. 20 minutes, 30 minutes later, same as the studio. But now the studio, they have mix stations at every place. Guys just sit down, put their headphones on. They do. It's already done. They've sent them the you know.
Yeah, they have what they want to hear.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so great. Now, I mean,
What gear are you using? What gear do you? Like, who's your endorsements?
Ooh, I am still a loud and proud Yamaha Zildjian Remo Regal Tip guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. And you have a signature stick. Don't you have a signature stick?
I did have a signature stick. But I think years ago, they took my Regal Tip, decided that they wanted to take my stick and put it into their general population. They actually took the model that I created and made it a regular model in their lineup. So,
oh, okay. Cool.
So, yeah. So,
God that bless Joe. He turned 100 years old, man.
Oh my God. So good.
Carol and Kathy, they do a great job of, you know, keeping, you know, it's hard these times for everybody. You know,
I know.
Pandemic, you know, we all know we don't have to.
Yeah. Yeah.
That goes without saying.
Yeah.
So now, live and in the studio, do you use pretty much the same kit or different kits? Always different, right?
It changes. Yeah, it changes. I did a session just last night and swapped out, you know, I had a 22, 10, 12, 14, 16. You know, most guys, you know, when I think one of the most common setups now you see live and in a studio is like, you know, kick, snare, you get one rack and maybe one or two floors, right? That's like the become sort of like the en vogue, you know, in vogue kind of thing. But I was, last couple of weeks, I've been doing some tracks for an artist in Canada that's kind of like Steely Danny a little bit. So I need that 10, I need that 12, I need those, I need to go back and have that setup where I have 10, 12, 14, 16 with a 22. Yesterday I did a session where I needed a 24, 13, 16, 18. So, and obviously, crashes always change, snares always change, and I have, you know, as many of us do, an assortment of toys when it comes to snare drums, you know.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, for sure. It's so fun.
More than we'll ever need, but
more than we'll ever need. It's the one thing.
That's what our wives and girlfriends always say.
yeah, really. There's no more room for more snares. Right.
All right. So let's go back to the beginning. I know you were born in Toronto and come from Canada. Yep. And then I think, when did you move to LA? I think 2004, right?
2005. Yes. Oh, wow. That's a great, great catch. Yes. 2004. Yeah.
So, and your dad, because, you know, you've been in Modern Drummer before. So, of course, I've interviewed you before. Yeah. But your dad, I forgot about that till I did a little, you know, went back to look at some stuff, and Dad was a player, so tell us a little bit about Dad and growing up.
He was, I have a picture. I used to have it as my Facebook picture profile, but it's a picture of me. I was 6 months old, and I'm leaning on a sofa, and there's a marching snare drum, chrome marching snare in front of me, and the sticks are in my hands, and I'm actually holding them traditional. 6 months old, I'm propped up. My mom, you could see my mother's arms holding me, because if she lets go, I'm just going to fall over. And they put my dad's Toronto Scottish pipe band beret on my head. And so that's proof in the pudding that through osmosis, there were sticks and snare drums around me from birth. My dad was more of a marching drummer in the Toronto Scottish pipe band. He at one point had a little jazz kit and had it in the living room at one point fooling around, but really his influence on me and that process was all about rudimental drumming. And for me as a young teenager, even younger, like 12 years old, I started, I joined a marching band, but I didn't want to wear the kilt, you know, the skirt. It's like, no way. You know, that's when, you know, dad's not so cool anymore, right?
Yeah.
But I had already, you know, my dad had already shown me my rudiments when, you know, as I was growing up. And so I joined the Cadet Lancers of Etobicoke in Toronto. I joined a marching band. My dad was always, I remember going, my mom taking me to watch him in parades in the Toronto Scottish pipe band, because he was, and that drumming is completely different. And in my opinion, harder. Like it's all swung, it's all like pressed rudiments, none of them are open, it's, you know, so but that was how
you're carrying everything.
yeah right. So man, I remember in my marching band, even at age 12, 13 years old, we were like the like considered the baby band. We weren't like the sort of 16 to 18 years old where the guys are really going crazy. I wasn't at that level. I was like mid-level, like the age group was younger, but I still remember parades where, you know, the guys that had to carry the kettle drums, like there was a dude, the kids that had to carry these drums, these massive drums. At the end of every parade, they had oxygen tanks and masks waiting. The poor kid would walk over to the sidewalk, take the drum off and just fall. And literally, because you're marching in 90 degree heat with 90 degree humidity, these kids are like, you know, just barely getting through it. But, you know, that those are my experience, like coming up for drumming and rudiments. Then I got into
That's all good, getting your hands in shape. I mean, that's the first thing you want to do anyway.
I think so. And I that's probably why, as a young music listener, I gravitated towards players like Steve Gadd and players like that, because I could hear it in his playing. Clearly, even some of his iconic drum grooves, you can hear the rudimental, you know, and I love that. I kind of love that marriage of hearing those rudiments, those open rudiments and whatever, you know, just being.
And I think also you're amazing with grace notes. So I think a lot of that, because of your feel, I think a lot of that came into play. Would you say that came into play?
1,000%. The grace note thing in grooves is a direct derivative of paying so much attention to the dynamics and just playing rudiments alone between accents and, you know, imagine in marching corps, like they're looking at your stick heights. They're like, when you get judged, they're judging you on stick height. You know, the drums all have to be the same level, even no matter how tall or short you were.
Right. That was the other thing. It's all visual as well.
It's visual, has to look the same. And so, you know, that was really a good base for understanding how important that is to why a groove, why that guy plays the same groove and this guy plays it, but this one feels a little better. Why? Right. It's really just that, to be honest with you.
It's that discipline of knowing.
It's that spread, you know? Can you get your grace notes a little softer and your accents a little louder? Can you do that and make that, you know, yeah.
Feel good. Yeah, no, you're great. That's a very strong point of yours, that everybody gravitates to the way, to your feel. So obviously that had a lot to do with it. So now going back besides dad, who like did dad, what records did dad play you, like bands? Did he turn you on to any people?
You know, my folks were like, listen to you know, adult radio. Like all I heard was pop radio hits and folk music. I didn't grow up listening to really any specific genre, to be honest with you, just radio, right? Just so, which is good though. I sort of came up listening to things that were produced and made it on the radio, which means they've gone through the process of being a good song and being produced well, and the drummer's not playing crazy. You know what I mean? Like I learned restraint. I learned in context, playing fills that made sense to the song. All that stuff. And then, you know, oddly enough, when I was 15 years old, I joined my first band because I was Cub Scouts from 10 years old with a bunch of boys from, you know, the East Coast of Canada. And one was from Jamaica. And I ended up in a band called Phase Four, seven guys. I was the only white kid, six black guys. And all we played was funk, reggae, and disco, and dance. And that's all I knew. And I mean, like, you know, old school funk, what we call old school funk now was just funk then. But you know, the
groove, that's all that stuff is groove oriented.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I started taking lessons, I remember seeing guys with books under their arm, you know, like, you know, everybody had the Neil Peart book. Everybody had the Drummer's Cookbook, you know, it took me a long time to take that leap into rock, into chops of fills. Like all I knew was drum beats. Like, just that's all I knew.
Well, that set you up for being a studio musician. That was the perfect setup.
Yeah.
Without even knowing that, you know, because all that comes in subconsciously about how important a song is. Like you said, all the elements. If there was a song on the radio, you know, we all wanted to be Hal Blaine. You know, we all wanted to play on everything. You know, I would turn the radio on, and I wish I played on that. Oh, I wish I played on that. Oh, I would love that.
Oh, yeah, right?
That'll help.
Yeah, so I mean, now, really.
Who would you say, besides dad, you know, was your biggest influence growing up?
The one guy other than Steve Gadd, because of that sort of rudimental stuff that I heard in his playing, and then the amazing, you know, musical song approaches that Steve had to what he was doing, was Stuart Copeland from The Police. Think about me being in this reggae band in Toronto, and all of a sudden, you know, I was exposed to another guy playing reggae. Here was this white guy playing reggae, and I was like, oh, this is amazing. Like, he's playing fills that I hear from Bob Marley albums, and he gets it. Like, he's playing all, you know, kick drums on the three, not on the one. Like, I was like, who is, you know, this band, The Police? Oh my God. Anyway, so The Police and Stuart Copeland's playing was a huge influence on my approach, on my hi-hat, on my attention to hi-hat. Think about how musical he was. You know, that part of his drum set playing was always like dancing around and, you know, very dynamic. Anyways, I loved all that stuff. So yeah, for sure, Stuart Copeland.
Favorite song. get lost in each other's eyes. Forget all that is wrong. Know you're my salvation. I can't live without your love. Oh no, you're the one. There's no other. We were made for each other, and there's no one I'd rather give my love to. You're the one. There's no other. We were made for each other, and there's no one I'd rather give my love to. You're my love and you're my life, and you make me feel alright. No, until the end of time, I'll be working endlessly, try to be better me for your love. You're the one, there's no other. We were made for each other, and there's no one I'd rather give my love to.
Yeah.
Cool. And now the way that some people may not know, but the way that you and I met was through Ringo Starr.
Yeah. Wow. What a bucket list event in my life.
through our buddy Ringo. I mean, let's go through the process. So you got the gig with Dave Stewart of the Eurythmics first, right? You were playing with Dave. Still playing with today. You know. Let's tell that story about how that all came about, because Randy was in Ringo's band for his TV promotion for the Liverpool 8 album. And then you tell the story about going to Liverpool and.
Oh, my God. Well, it wouldn't be fair without quickly just really bullet pointing the path to sort of Dave, because that, you know, it's because of Dave Stewart and Dave Stewart using his players to bring into Ringo's promotional tour for Liverpool 8. But how I got to Dave Stewart, really quickly, I'm in LA and I have a friend in Toronto that manages a singer from a band. And there's a guy in Buffalo that manages that band. Toronto guy manages the singer. The Buffalo guy manages the band. So they always have to talk to each other about touring schedules. Can I get the singer? Can I have the band? That kind of thing. In that conversation on the phone, the Buffalo guy says, hey, I'm putting a band together for Ian Gillan from Deep Purple. I have everybody, but I don't have a drummer. And my friend who I played in bands with, who was at the time working for Rush's management, SRO, he says, I got your guy. Call this guy. He's from Toronto, but he's in LA right now, but he'd be perfect for the gig. So he gives my number. He reaches out to me and he says, Andy Curran in Toronto reaches out to me, and this fellow's name, who's still a dear friend, Michael Lee Jackson, is not only Ian's personal manager, he's his entertainment lawyer, and he's going to play guitar in the band.
Wow.
So he's wearing three hats, and he reaches out to me and says, "You come highly recommended. Could you send me some music?" So I, of course, pull together a couple of MP3s that I feel are in that vein, that bowl, and I send him the Rick Emmett CD, Rick Emmett's breakout CD, after he left Triumph. And there's a track on that CD called Drive Time, and it's a very fast shuffle. And I sent him this stuff, and a day later he calls me up and he goes, "I heard 8 bars of Drive Time and I knew you were the guy. That was it. Let's talk schedule. Let's talk." Okay. So now I'm on the Ian Gillan tour. We start on the East Coast of America, and we're going to go all the way to the West Coast. And I end
up. Were you also doing Deep Purple songs? Was he doing any Deep Purple?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Wow,
In every city, they ran a radio contest, and a local guitar player could come up on stage with us and play Smoke on the Water. It was to see these young kids, you know, girls, guys, like, just, it was, dream come true for them, and super exciting for us. So we make our way to the West Coast. We get to LA. Last gig, Sunset Strip, the House of Blues. I'm in the dressing room, and there's this big guy, and big black guy. He's got wearing all black. He's got black sunglasses, and he's like just super cool. And I don't know what he's doing in the dressing room. He's just all like sort of quiet. And I meet him. This is before the gig. He says, "My name is Michael Bradford." And I go, "Hi, Michael, it's great to meet you." And I don't really even at that point know if he's a friend or. It turns out he produced the last Deep Purple album. He was the bass player in Kid Rock's band.
Oh, right.
He's a legend already. And I'm just stupid and I don't even know. So we go on stage. And it turns out that night on our last tour, Michael Bradford is going to come out and do Smoke on the Water. He's going to be the guest, and Ian introduces him. And so after the show, we all make friends. We exchange numbers. It was great to meet you. And a couple of months later, Michael and I start working together. I start playing on some demos for him. Michael puts Dave Stewart's band together because he was Dave's musical director.
Right. That's right.
That's how I got to play with Ringo. And imagine, the first time I talked to Ringo was on the phone. I was doing a demo with Dave in LA where I was set up, and we're sitting in the control room, and Dave just goes, "Here." And he hands me the phone, like, doesn't tell me anything, just hands me someone, go, "Here, someone wants to say hello." And I go, "Hello," and it's Ringo Starr. Great. Thanks. Anyways, we had a very lovely and brief conversation. I was like, very excited to meet you. And, what do you say? Come on. I don't want to draw this out, but it's pretty intense and amazing and exciting to talk to one of your icons.
And then go on tour and play double drums.
Oh my God. And we didn't,
Shows. I mean, how long did that? It was like a year, right?
It was about half a year. I think it caps about half a year.
The whole promo, all the TV shows.
Yeah. And we literally met on stage, at soundcheck, like walk on stage. There's the two drum kits, so it's many things at once. It's exciting. You're nervous as hell. You're trying to contain all these things, and you're a drummer playing with another drummer. Forget about all of the obvious, crazy, intense things that are going through your head.
Right.
Well, you look into your left and there's a Beatle. Like, try not to think about that, but now you're going to have to play with another drummer. There's a dance and a marriage that happens, and of course, I'm going to let him lead. I'm going to follow him. And it truly was a dance. I can't say and have said on the record, and I love saying this, that playing with two drummers is not the most simple thing at all. Everybody has their own pocket, their own time, their own feel, but probably the easiest drummer I've ever played with has been Ringo Starr. And that's not a word of a lie. He just has an internal clock that is beautiful. Like he just, his feel playing along with him was just effortless. And so I would just play with him. If he started a triplet fill, I would let him get halfway in the bar and then I would finish a triplet fill with him. He does a triplet, I do straight 16s. You know, I never want to do that. I always let him start, lead. Like if he's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, then I'm gonna join in at the end of the bar with 16s. I'm listening all the time to where he is, right? So, but yeah, it was amazing. So
yeah, that was a great period of time. And you know, and at the time, you kind of were still like a little under the radar, you know, and I guess Ringo really believed in Dave Stewart, obviously, that he just said, you know, he just completely left it up to Dave.
You know, you can use your guys, yeah.
Yeah, you know, we'll use your band, and it worked. And I remember the girl violin player was in that band.
Yeah, oh my God. So the whole band was just top notch. I mean, amazing, yeah.
Yeah. And that whole record, that period, that obviously Liverpool 8 was the record that they produced. And then you wind up going to Liverpool for Ringo's big like homecoming, and I think
it was crazy.
City, and
it was like Liverpool that year had been named City of Culture. I think that switches each year to a European City of Culture, and all of those planets were in alignment for Ringo that year because he has a CD called Liverpool 8. He's going to perform in Liverpool in the same year that CD is released, and Liverpool is a city of culture. And I think there were about 80,000 people in the core of the city, and we were on a roof.
I know. We ran photos. Rob Shanahan took the photos. We ran them in Modern Drummer, full page spread, and you're on that overlooking. It was a gorgeous shot.
It was crazy. It was crazy. Yeah.
That's a great memory. Those are all great, great memories.
It is, for sure. And everything, all the TV shows we did were incredible. I mean, we did the Craig Kilborn show. Craig didn't have any other guests that night. He only had Ringo. So we just kept playing songs. He'd keep interviewing Ringo. We just played that song. And
And Rachel Ray, that's when I hung out with all you guys. You introduced me to Dave that day. And that was a great day. I mean, we had Rachel Ray cooking for us.
Amazing. It's great memories. And it was amazing. Obviously, too, like, I know we haven't really said it, but Billy, you're a little bit of a legend yourself, my friend. And so it was amazing for me to meet you. Come on. Dude, from this high, we grow up, you know, idolizing that magazine. And like, it was is the only magazine for decades that cater to drummers and drumming and there you were at the throne, so to speak. And so finally to meet you also and hang out with you was very special for me, and I consider that
thank you. Okay, thank you. And now I have to give you don't have to pay me, you could keep that.
I get the $5 back.
I've been making notes. I got a calculator. I think it was $22.50, so
right. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Before we let you go, I mean, Kelly Clarkson, you played on her hit albums when she was at her peak, correct?
I did. Yeah. It's funny. I did the demo for her first single in Toronto because the writer was a friend of mine. And then the second single called Walk Away, I played on in Los Angeles, produced by and written by a completely different set of Canadians, Rain Maida and Chantel Kraviazic. So I got to do that. And then a couple of CDs later, I'm on another single.
Stronger, right? I think.
Yeah, Stronger, yeah.
Stronger, yeah. I mean, that was a huge hit for her.
It's a great song. I get, you know, from the sublime to the ridiculous, like I said, I'm lucky in terms of sometimes I do a song that I don't even know about till a year later. Like a couple of months ago, Noel says to me, you know, there's an Olivia Rodrigo song that you're on. It's double platinum right now. This song. And I'm like, and I say, no, I don't think that's me. And she goes, I remember when you were charting it. I remember when you were listening to it, making notes. I remember that song. And she goes, come listen to it here. Is that you? And I actually had to text the producer, the writer, and say, is that me? Did I do that?
Right.
He goes, yeah. I was like, okay, great. I ordered my
get another gold platinum record.
You know, it's just for my own. You know, those awards are for the day when the phone just stops ringing and I can just sit on the stairs and go, what? Remember the day when someone liked my playing?
No, hey, let me tell you though, that in the music business, we all know how the music business is. You need that encouragement. Otherwise, we'd really all be insane.
Right? Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, thank you.
I know Alanis Morissette was from Canada. When did you play with her? Because I know you played with her as well.
I did a very short little writing stint with her. It's funny. I got to play with some crazy, amazing people, but sometimes it's like a 3-day demo session, 3 days at a studio. So I did 3 days at a studio in Toronto with Alanis, just writing sessions. Her on grand piano, an upright bass player, and me. And she would just turn to me and say, start a loop, play a groove. And I'd just play, and she would just stream of consciousness, like they just roll tape just all day. And that was how that session went. I did another 3-day session in Los Angeles once with Mick Jagger. It was Mick Jagger and Dave Stewart and Michael Bradford. And same thing, just sitting around cranking out demos. And, you know, sometimes these things just end up on hard drives. But still you have that experience. You get to hang out and play. At one point I got to punch Mick's vocals.
Wow.
Michael had to step out for just a minute, and Dave's on the sofa, and he says, Mick's standing out on the floor. He wants to punch in. And do you know how to work Pro Tools? I said, yeah. So I sit at the desk, and I tell you, my hands are shaking. Like all I have to do is hit space bar and then the number 3 key to put it into record. I say the talkback, hey, Mick, okay, you ready? Yeah. Okay. I literally, that lasted 5 minutes, and then Michael walks back in, and I literally leap out of the chair. But these are the experiences you get to have.
Magic moments. Yeah. And then planned. You see, circumstance. I always go through the circumstance. It's like everything falls into place the way it's supposed to fall into place.
Yeah. Yeah.
And magic moments. You know, that's what keeps us all in this business.
I think so, and I'm still a firm believer in saying yes to as much of everything as possible. I really feel like it's about connecting with as many musical situations and people as possible, regardless of money, regardless of, you know, it's always going to be about scheduling.
Right.
Can I physically do this? If I can, the answer is always yes.
And that's great advice, because I was going to ask you before we leave, to finish up here, is what advice do you have for especially our younger, you know, because now modern drummer, you know, we're embracing a whole new younger audience now that's starting to grow with us, and what advice, you know, with your and you give them?
That's part of it. Other than the new arena that we're in regarding click tracks, everybody's using tracks. I mean, you have to feel comfortable with metronomes and clicks. So you might as well start, whether it's live, even if you're not in the studio a lot and you're practicing with your band in your mom's basement, it doesn't matter. Put a click in for a little bit and just get used to it. It doesn't have to be all the time. It doesn't have to be, you know, 100%, but you need to not be afraid of it. You need to be able to feel comfortable with it, because it's coming for you. When you get that touring gig, you're going to have a click. So you might as well. So that's one. And the last one is the business side is, you know, the question about how much a gig pays or a session pays should be the last question, if asked at all. Because you want to have faith in people that they're going to be fair with you. And most, I got to be honest with you, 99.9% of the time, the person that's asking you to do something, they know they're asking you.
Right.
If they only have $20, $100, it's because they only have $100. They're not going to, you know, most of the, almost, you know, 99 times out of 100. So you're good. You don't have to make that conversation. You don't have to pull that conversation there. I always feel like money is like, because the money will come.
Yeah. You know? And like you said, like, you don't know, you could play on something and then a year later it's out and it's a gold record, you know.
Or you could play for somebody for nothing, and a year later they call you and they have a paying tour.
Right.
And the reason they called you over somebody else is because you weren't that person. You never made it about that. And and that's a characteristic I think that should be adopted as you come up the ladder.
Great advice. Well, listen, thank you so much for taking
look at this guy. I want to reach through the camera and hug you.
Thank you, Billy.
Wow,
we had a good time when we did the you came, you were one of my guests at the 50th anniversary of the Beatle Fest with Hal Blaine and James Gadson. We had some fun that weekend.
Oh my god, thank you again. Amazing.
Some fun. Well, I'm so proud of all your success, man. Continued success. Please stay safe on the road.
Thanks. And you and your family, I wish the best for you and your family as well.
Thank you. And everyone out there in Modern Drummer Land, thank you, Randy.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. We'll see you next on the Modern Drummer Podcast.
Woohoo!
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.